The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
This episode of the Lawfare podcast is supported by Slanted, How an Asian American Troublemaker Took on the Supreme Court. Slanted is available wherever books are sold. For a free sample, listeners can go to www.slantedbook.com.
Their indoctrinator going into these schools to learn about all of the things that make the Kim family great, why Kim Il-sung did certain things and why we should follow in Kim Il-sung's steps, all the wonderful things that Kim Jong-il did, and now all of the things that Kim Jong-un did. So all, you know, these, the mythology, the education, the ideology are steeped, the country is steeped with all of these ideas of Kim family greatness. You know, and all of those questions came to the fore in the past 3 weeks when Kim Jong-un was absent from public view about, you know, what does that mean for the next Kim? What does that mean for, you know, who might succeed? Can North Korea stomach another Kim, or would there be some sort of military group that would be taking power?
I'm Benjamin Wittes, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, May 5th, 2020. Jung Pak is a Brookings Senior Fellow and a close colleague. She is also a former CIA analyst and North Korea specialist. She is the author of Becoming Kim Jong-un, a former CIA officer's insights into North Korea's enigmatic young dictator. She joined me in the remote jungle studio to discuss Kim Jong-un, the recent questions about whether he had died or become seriously ill, his rise to power, and his confrontations with Donald Trump over nuclear weapons. It's a wide-ranging conversation, a peek into the Hermit Kingdom, and a look at the world's only dynastic communist regime. It's the Lawfare Podcast, May 5th, Jung Pak on Becoming Kim Jong-un. I want to start with the news, which has been, as always, with respect to North Korea, confusing about whether the subject of your book is even still alive. There was a spree of leaks and press and assessments suggesting he may be dead or sick, or he may have had heart surgery, or he may have COVID-19. He disappeared for a while, and then on Friday, I believe, the North Korean government released a series of pictures of him at a factory. How confident are you at this point that you have written a book about a man who is still among the living?
Thanks, Ben. Yeah, so the North Korean regime pictures from Friday seem legitimate. But, you know, that the fact that he's reappeared and at the celebration at the opening of this fertilizer plant on Friday doesn't tell us anything about where he was or what he was doing in the past 3 weeks. I don't think the health issue is not going to go away. I mean, he's well enough to be at this plant opening and cutting the ribbon and doing all the things that a North Korean leader does. But, you know, the fact of the matter is that he is not a healthy person, given his health history, his family history of heart disease, and other issues. And so, you know, the health question still remains, and all of the implications for U.S. policy and regional stability and internal stability still remain, regardless of whether, you know, he showed up on Friday or if he shows up 2 weeks from now.
What do we know about his health? And do you assume that the disappearance for 3 weeks was in fact a health crisis of some sort? What can we responsibly say about this mysterious period of Kim's not appearing in public?
He disappeared with respect to what we know about his health is that we can see this. We can see that he's not in great shape, even through the soft filters of regime media, that he is overweight. He's only 5'6 or 5'7. And he's probably in the high 200s range, if not at the 300 mark. In 2014, he had ankle surgery allegedly for gout or gout-related issues. In the past 2 years of Summitry, we can hear him wheezing. We can hear him laboring to walk a short distance and breathing heavily. And so those are the observables, and as well as what the regime has shown and stated about his health. And what can we responsibly say? We don't know. We don't know what happened in the past 3 weeks. The reporting came from all over the place. The rumors came from all over the place. They came from Chinese chat rooms to South Korean news outlets to U.S. reportedly U.S. officials and who are monitoring intelligence, according to CNN. So the rumors and the reporting came from all over the place, but they don't give us any indications of what exactly was wrong. Another thing that we saw was that his train was at the beach resort in Wonsan, which is on the eastern coast. That also was really interesting, and that would that supported some reporting that suggested that he was there trying to self-quarantine or social distance. But again, that's not diagnostic of his actual health status or even his presence.
There was a time when people talked about his weight gain as though it were intentional, an effort to look more like his grandfather rather than as a health problem. He's young. I mean, he's still young.
Yes.
And so is the best way to understand his health status? I mean, we're dealing, as we will talk about, we're dealing with a broad picture here that you're piecing together with very relatively few pieces of uncertain reliability. But is the best way to understand his health status that he is a kind of could be gone any time, or is the best way to understand it that, look, he's a young guy with some health problems, but young people who are sort of, you know, seriously overweight live for a long time a lot of the time?
Kim Jong-un does have his age going for him. He's only 36. And so despite his weight, he still has that going for him. There were rumors in the beginning that he was intentionally gaining weight to try to look more like his grandfather, Kim Il-sung, who was the country founder. But, his weight has really fluctuated and really grown over the years. I mean, we can see this over the years. And what I thought was notable when he reappeared was that he didn't look demonstrably different from 3 weeks ago. So there wasn't too much of a big change in that aspect. But I think that, you know, that will always be his wild card. His health will always be a wild card in terms of figuring out what that means for North Korea's future. You know, he's got the best of the healthcare and medical services that can be provided for him. He's got his own family hospital in a nearby province. And the regime has enough funds to fly the best doctors in or get the best healthcare. So he's got his age and the fact that he's got the resources at his disposal.
So let's turn to the book. You are, as the last 3 weeks illustrate, you are writing about a remarkably elusive subject. You write at the beginning of the book that, you know, you quote the old adage of, about North Korea in the intelligence community, that it is the hardest of hard targets. Talk to us about the process of writing about a leader when you are really peering through a keyhole at a very complicated room.
Yeah, you know, working on North Korea is really humbling and uncomfortable. It's, you know, I started at the agency back in early 09. So at the beginning of the Obama administration, when he came in and he said, you know, he wanted to reset ties with North Korea, Iran, Burma, Cuba, et cetera. And I was coming down to, I was in DC coming from New York, you know, relatively fresh from my PhD in US history. So not that much of a background in North Korea per se. And so when I started, it was right after his father's stroke in late 2008. And I went through all the training, watching all of this and looking at the reporting, watching his grooming process and teasing out the information, trying to piece together the puzzles. And then when he came to power at the end of 2011, after his father died, that was when it was really, we're in business. Came out swinging. Kim Jong-un came out swinging. There was no period of, learning the ropes. He came out swinging in terms of deciding to explode the Leap Day agreement that his father had agreed on with the Obama administration. He tested a rocket that year and then another one in December. And so he came out, saying that, basically, insisting on his status and to be respected as the North Korean leader, despite the fact that the world was looking at him as if that this was internal collapse was likely. This is the end of North Korea as we know it. Some analysts said, and a lot of the North Korea analysis when we write for the president or brief members of Congress or military officials, it's that a lot of it has to be based on your knowledge of the culture, the history, the internal drivers of the regime's decision making. So it's very it's uncomfortable, and we caveat all of that with the confidence level. We never have high confidence on various things because that would require a lot of reporting to back that up, and usually we don't have all of that. All of those ironclad things that would suggest a high certainty or high level of confidence. And so, looking at Kim, looking at some of his observable actions, the regime's observable statements and the history, try to craft together an assessment that's usable and actionable for the president and for policymakers. But in general, it's a deeply uncomfortable and unsettling job to do is to look at this regime. The North Koreans, I think, are pretty unique in how they've closed off their society and their regime decision making. It's closed off on the inside. It's closed off to the outside. So they have really robust counterintelligence practices that really prevents our opening of the door even more. And so we have to continue to peek through that keyhole. I would say that, though, in the past 2 years, we've seen a lot more in terms of because of the summits. We can see, how Kim is doing physically. We can see what he's signing, what he's saying to the president, what he's saying to the South Korean president. And so some of his actions over the past 2 years has shown us that this is pretty consistent with what his father had done in terms of using diplomacy to try to gain some political or economic concessions. So we have to look at actions as well as statements and some of the history and our assessment and my assessment of what is exactly driving him. And so in the book, I look at the history, I look at the legacies and the burdens of that he has to bear in terms of the regime's legacies. He can't give up nuclear weapons. It's his grandfather's and his father's legacy, for one.
So when you write a book as opposed to an intelligence product for the president, you have a little bit more freedom, right? The book is framed, among other things, as a narrative. It's a history. There's a bit of history of the regime in the first few chapters. There's some, you know, biographical material, both about his grandfather and his father. And then there's this story about him coming into power and becoming the leader who he's become. When you write intelligence product, you have to be extremely disciplined about what you are and what you aren't allowed to say, right? And you have to bracket everything with what kind of confidence level you have in it. Here, you don't really have to do that. And so tell me about how writing a book about Kim Jong-un is different from writing intelligence product about the North Korean regime.
Yeah, thanks, Ben. The intelligence product, you know, we update daily. They're very tactical, very dry. I think no human being should be, it's not a natural writing style. There are no adverbs, there are no adjectives. It's very cut and dry. And I would say that, you know, usually when we write the intelligence products, the bluff is up front. That's the, you know, the bottom line up front. And then you provide the most salient pieces of evidence to support your bluff. In the book, with the book, I flip that around. I don't say what my argument is up front. I let the story develop and unfold. And then I end with the, with some policy suggestions and what and how we need to address the nuclear weapons program, how we need to approach the North Korea problem. It's very different. And I tell the story from a broad, sweeping, historical, cultural narrative perspective versus these very tight half page or one paragraph or two page assessment on North Korea. This was a different writing style. You know, I had almost when I came out of the agency, it was a little bit of a huge difference, actually, in terms of how I'm switching my writing style. But, you know, this allows me to reach back into my liberal arts, you know, history PhD roots and try to tell the story of this person within this context and have as many pages as I can. So, you know, having 250 pages of North Korea and focusing on Kim Jong-un was a really luxury for me. And I'm glad to have had that opportunity.
So the story opens at the funeral of his father, which is a kind of public pageant of sorts. He is flanked, as you described, by a series of old guard military figures. And this is widely interpreted as evidence that he is kind of the prince regent and they are the real power. And this goes along with sort of senses of him as, you know, basically a child or a boy king kind of thing. And within a very short period of time, he has purged and in some cases murdered the old man walking behind him. He's very clearly in charge, and he has assumed the 70-year history of the family cult and made it work for him. So how does he do it? Basically, everything people were saying about him in 2011 turned out to be wrong. What did he have going for him that people didn't appreciate?
Yeah, you know, when I look back on that scene, the gaze, I think, was on the people other than Kim. Who else in the regime might be the wielders of the, who might be wielding the power, right? Who might be propping him up? But I start the scene and remind people of the grief and that, so he's not just a young man at this age. I mean, he's 27 at that funeral. He's also an orphan. You know, his mother died when he was 20. His father died when he was only 27. So that's a lot of loss within just a short span of years. And so in that way, looking at the elderly officials around him, the grief on his face, the fact that he was now an orphan. It was easy to discount his strength and to underestimate what he might be able to do because of his age, because the grooming period was so compressed. The grooming period, really, the succession process only really got jump-started after the Kim Jong-il's stroke in 2008. So that was only 3 years. Whereas the Kim Jong-il had decades of, you know, tutelage under his father. So all of those things contributed to this sense that, you know, he was not to be taken seriously. But I think before any of that gelled, he came out swinging. He purged within 2 years, 5 of the 7 people who were helping him, you know, who were surrounding that hearse, and then marginalized, and the ensuing years marginalized the other two. And the fact that he did that so quickly, I think made people and officials and outsiders unable to get their footing. And he had the element of surprise. He had the initiative. So it was his swagger and his confidence, but it was also that he had this, you know, 7 decades worth of a regime that was built on repression and fear. And so you have the regime, he had inherited all of those structures, including overlapping security apparatuses, a neighborhood watch system in which there was a neighborhood person chief in charge of making sure that she knew how many spoons you had and how many people, if you had any visitors. And so, you know, all of this inherited repressive structure also assisted him in making sure that he could cement his role. So he started, you know, with a very aggressive posture as soon as he came in. And that funeral and the way he was very, you know, self-composed and mournful, that was just, you know, that was for the funeral. But in the behind the scenes, he was very aggressive. And I also think that, you know, there was this, it's a confidence, I think, born of privilege, somebody who for whom no one really said no, given the fact that he was surrounded. And his father was also surrounded by sycophants, by officials trying to curry favor, and the fact that they had all of these resources at their disposal to be able to reward elite. And so it's not just the repression either, but it's also that there are interests supporting his rule that reinforce the Kim rule, and that their interests, economic, political, educational, and otherwise, are tied to his success. So he was able to, you know, harness all of those, the inherited as well as his confidence and his aggressiveness, to cement his power and to be where he is, which is, you know, after clocking multiple summits with the U.S. president, the South Korean president, the top leader in China, as well as in Russia. So he's come a long way since the winter day in December of 2011.
The Lawfare podcast this week is brought to you by the book Slanted, How an Asian American Troublemaker Took on the Supreme Court. In this book, the author Simon Tam offers a unique behind-the-scenes perspective for one of the most discussed and influential Supreme Court cases in the 2017 term. Slanted is the story of an indomitable spirit, one who's so committed to the idea of justice that he's literally willing to risk everything along the way for the dignity of self-identity. If you enjoy personal stories behind major legal battles, you'll appreciate this book, which tackles a really important and complex set of legal issues using approachable, everyday, funny storytelling. Simon's story is one of the few that united people from across the political aisle. It involved the ACLU and the Cato Institute because it involved deep values that Americans share. The book is a story about hope. It's a story about overcoming adversity, even when the opponent is the federal government of the United States. It's an irrepressible story. It's fresh, it's alive, and it defines what it means to be an American. It's the perfect gift for law students for attorneys, for anyone interested in public policy and rock and roll. So as a general reader and someone who loves legal narrative and does it for a living, this story provides a raw look at the legal system, and it does it with unflinching honesty. It gives all kinds of timely insights on freedom of speech and how to connect with others we disagree with, and of course, the power of music. So, you know, I really, really enjoyed it. The book is Slanted, How an Asian American Troublemaker Took on the Supreme Court, and it's available wherever books are sold. For a free sample, listeners can go to www.slantedbook.com. So one of the things that we really noticed about Kim Jong-un, in a fashion kind of similar to Mohammed bin Salman in Saudi Arabia, who is also young, aggressive, and cementing his power, is that he's murderous. You know, whether it's his uncle whom he kills with an anti-aircraft gun in front of a large group of people, or his half-brother whom he has murdered with a chemical weapons attack. You know, he's into a kind of theatrical murder style. Is that a creature of him, or is that a larger creature of the regime?
It's a bit of both, but I think it's him, in that these are very theatrical, and it was very shocking to have family members executed and purged in that way. What was shocking about the uncle by marriage and what happened with his half brother is that, you know, when there's an agreement, disagreement in the family, these family members are shuffled away for some re-education, and then they reemerge. And that was true of the uncle by marriage. And the half brother had been roaming around and, you know, and pretty much in exile for the past few decades. But the spectacular, very public and humiliating way that this all happened by this young dictator was really a wake-up call for a lot of people. And I think it was absolutely done for the domestic population as well, that no one is safe. What I think is interesting about the uncle is that, you know, it happened within the first 2 years of Kim's rule. But I think that there was a case that was being made against the uncle in those 2 years. You know, in the way that there was a lengthy indictment of the uncle, of all of these things that he allegedly did, corruption, trying to foment a coup against Kim Jong-un for not being, of the socialist mindset. I mean, this was a lengthy, very highly articulated indictment of the uncle. And so that, and the way that he did it, the uncle was stooped over. This was a man who had all these levers of power. He was once thought to be, you know, the real person in command. He had all of these, these really powerful networks. The last picture that we see of him is being hunched over. He looks older than his age. He's being escorted out by guards. And it was a very humiliating and for this man who seemed to have the rest of his, you know, at least a few more decades of power in him. With the half brother, it was, you know, when you look at some of the images that ricocheted around the world, it was, you know, his stomach was hanging out, his shirt was half, you know, was untucked and rolled up to his rib cage. His eyes were rolled back, and you know, these images are horrible. The way he was writhing in pain, and that was all shown on CCTV. And these very public demonstrations of Kim's brutality was designed to show the world and for anybody inside, that this is what could happen to you. And this was also a way for Kim to prune the family tree, as I say in that chapter, that he doesn't want side branches doing their thing and trying to funnel power away from the center, which was Kim Jong-un. And this was a way to show elite that Kim Jong-un was not afraid to punish his own family members for acting against him or perceive to to be acting against the regime.
You know, one of the odd things about him is that it is a sort of communist Stalinist regime, but it is one that is organized around a family. And the dynastic nature of it is particularly evident in the comment you just made, right? He's not afraid of, you know, a kind of velvet revolution protests. He's afraid of other branches of the tree being the family, having greater claim to, for lack of a better word, I'll say the throne, than he has. In addition, the DPRK regime has had this kind of non-communist ideology associated, I've never known how to pronounce it, but Juche or something, which is, you know, a kind of nationalistic self-reliance ideology. How do you understand what this regime is philosophically and geopolitically and ideologically?
Juche, right, is you know, very roughly translated as self-reliance, is very flexible. And it encompasses all of these things, this ethno-racialism, this autonomy, sovereignty, but that the only person or the only family that can save that Juche or that self-reliance or autonomy and this purist idea of North Koreanism is the Kim family. And, you know, if you remember back in October 2019, Kim had taken this much derided horseback ride up to Mount Baekdu, which is at the border with China. And this is this place where the mythical god of the Korean nation had originated, allegedly where Kim Il-sung had a military base to fight against the Japanese, allegedly where his father, I mean, this is all according to regime propaganda, where Kim Jong-il was born. We know that probably was not true. And then Kim Jong-un goes there on horseback with his wife and his sister up to the mountain to pay tribute, but also to remind people where they came from. So it's not just where the family came from, but that, you know, they've grown it to this mythical idea of the Kim family being descended from this very sacred place. There are all these elements of North Korean or Korean history in all of this, and that is Confucianism, it is anti-colonialism, it is shamanism, it is, you know, the remnants of Japanese colonial or emperor worship, as well as Christianity. North Korea, Pyongyang used to be called Jerusalem of the East back in the 1910s. So all of those things have been encapsulated, adapted, molded to serve the Kim, that the regime has taken to serve the Kim family, especially the line that comes down from Kim Il-sung. And so, you know, when you have that kind of ethos, when you kind of have that ideology, you know, that's something that has to be continually learned and educated. And so it's not just the mythology or the ideology that's enough, but that the children are starting, you know, as soon as they're born, they're indoctrinated or going into these schools to learn about all of the things that make the Kim family great, why Kim Il-sung did certain things and why we should follow in Kim Il-sung's steps, all the wonderful things that Kim Jong-il did, and now all of the things that Kim Jong-un did. So all, you know, these the mythology, the education, the ideology are steeped. The country is steeped with all of these ideas of Kim family greatness. And, you know, and all of those questions came to the fore in the past 3 weeks when Kim Jong-un was absent from public view about, you know, what does that mean for the next Kim? What does that mean for, you know, who might succeed? Can North Korea stomach another Kim, or would there be some sort of military group that would be taking power?
And the implied answer from the whole trajectory of the book is that we might kid ourselves that there's some military power structure behind the young man in the funeral procession that's actually pulling the strings. But in fact, this is all about the Kim family, and that if Kim were to vanish from the scene tomorrow, there is no obvious alternative but another Kim, right?
Right. And I think that I had written last week about how, you know, we should not write off his sister, that she has the bloodline and she has the regime. She has government experience for the past 6 years, at least. She's had leadership positions. And so even if there were to be some military group, I think they would find it that it would be in their interest to have a Kim at the head, figurehead or not, to make sure that to have that legitimacy of the Kim family, given how much of that lore and ideology is in North Korea.
So let's talk about the nuclear components of the last several years and this aggressive young leader who everybody continually underestimates. He comes in, he accelerates the nuclear program, he gets into this standoff with Donald Trump, and then he ends up having a whole series of high-profile summits with Donald Trump that seem to go nowhere, other than optically, in terms of actually making substantial progress. I think we've talked a lot about this from the Trump administration standpoint in the kind of managing North Korea story. But let's talk about it from Kim Jong-un's point of view in terms of managing the United States, managing, you know, Donald Trump. What's the sort of North Korean, I don't mean their propaganda narrative, but to the extent that you've been able to divine a sense of their internal narrative of what's going on and how their foreign policy has worked in this period, what has Kim been trying to do and to what extent has he succeeded?
You know, I think as everybody was, the North Korean regime was trying to figure out what Donald Trump was about when he first came into office. And so, you know, we saw some reports where the regime had sent out some diplomats and other interlocutors to gauge from people they thought were close to the administration, you know, trying to figure out like what the policy of the Trump administration was. But, you know, President Trump came into office saying, tweeting almost immediately that, you know, North Korea says they're going to test an ICBM. It ain't going to happen, or it's not going to happen. And guess what? They did that year. And so from the North Korean perspective, I think this is new to Kim Jong-un, is that, you know, they're thinking in terms of the long term. They're thinking in terms of dynasties. In the U.S. and elsewhere, where we have elections and we have legislatures, we think in terms of every 4 years or every 8 years or every 2 years or every 6 years, depending on where you are. So Kim, I think, was looking at President Trump. And, you know, when President Trump back in March unilaterally said, I would really like to meet with Kim, you know, agree to meet with Kim for a summit, North Korea was quiet for a month. And I think that was because they were taken aback as much as everybody else was in trying to figure out what the next steps might be and how they might deal with how they might manage the situation to their benefit. And we've always said that you know, for the North Koreans, having this direct bilateral dialogue with the U.S. was what they want for status and to solidify their claimed, you know, legitimate nuclear weapons program and to sideline South Korea, China, which would be for North Korea's benefit. And so when this happened so quickly and so suddenly, with the president just saying that, yes, he'll meet with Kim Jong-un, I think they were trying to figure out what to do, which might explain that 1 month of not even acknowledging it. And I think that Kim, this was something that his grandfather and his father were not able to do, which was to score a meeting with the U.S. president. And unlike him, where we kind of have to, as you said earlier, look through the keyhole on his intentions, for Kim, he had tens and thousands of tweets that the president has written. He had, you know, multiple biographies and autobiographies and articles about the president to, you know, to try to glean insights about what is motivating the president. I mean, I think, you know, I've said this before, where it was probably worth trying to figure out what, you know, Kim would say and do when faced with the U.S. president, something, you know, this gold standard for the regime. But, you know, the president was also very clear that he did not prepare, and that it was clear that he was approaching this also from a point of view of a businessman from New York, whereas Kim was thinking of this, and I try to explain this in the book, Kim was thinking of this in terms of solidifying his own status. And I'm not sure that there was a complete understanding of how North Korea sees nuclear weapons as part of the brand and of regime survival. You know, I think Kim thought that, you know, here was an opportunity and that he could take advantage of the president's willingness and eagerness to meet. Before the Singapore summit, which was in June 2018, before the working level conversations could really get anything more substantive on the Singapore, what was to be the Singapore statement, the president, you know, wanted the meeting to happen on a certain date. So it was not in the North Koreans' interest to say anything more substantive or more meaty before the event, because they were going to get the event anyway. And I think at that point, the negotiators had their knees cut off even before they started, because the president had already said yes. So when I look at a summit, right, a summit is, you know, two leaders, you're at the peak. There are no guardrails. You know, how do you go back and how do you leverage that summit to gain progress? And, you know, so far, as we've seen in the past 2 years, you know, the North Koreans continue to maintain their facilities. They refurbished, ballistic missile facilities, probably building more, you know, making more fissile material. They're maintaining the nuclear test site. And they've said, and Kim Jong-un has said at the end of last year, beginning of this year, that he's not that interested in talks anymore until the U.S., you know, changes its ways.
And so did the sequence of policies that the U.S. under the Trump administration engaged in, which is to say a rhetorical escalation, sort of a flirtation with war, leading to this optical breakthrough in which they agree to meet, a series of meetings, I think a total of three face-to-face meetings, right. His sister's visit to the South for the Olympics, and all of these negotiations, did it produce anything of consequence, or is it really just a kind of administration fantasy that never came to anything?
When President Trump came back after the Singapore summit, I think he was still on the plane, and he tweeted that the nuclear problem was solved. You know, Kim Jong-un and the summits with Kim made it to campaign rallies and in the campaign and his campaign materials.
And there were love letters.
And the letters between them. So yes, I guess, I mean, the personal relationship between the two men seem okay. But that hasn't been translated into real policy success. The president has chosen to define denuclearization in a very narrow way, which is the absence or Kim's restraint in not conducting nuclear weapons testing or intercontinental ballistic missile testing. But the problem is that North Korea under Kim has diversified, made more mobile their ballistic missiles. They had the most powerful nuclear test back in September of 2017. So the weapon systems are more diverse and more reliable, and it's not just about the nuclear testing or the long-range ballistic missile testing, but that there are other weapons that are mobile, more reliable, they're diverse, including from submarine launch platforms that threaten the region, that threaten U.S. forces in the area, that and because of the North Korean testing of, three ICBMs back in 2017, they could have the capability to hit anywhere in the globe. But narrowly defining success with North Korea on those two items of no testing or no ballistic missile testing, those are very tenuous things. And I worry a lot about what that says to Kim, that as long as he doesn't do those things, that he can do other things, even as he continues covertly to develop methods and means for to bolster those and other capabilities. The problem, there's a long shadow, I think, of the fire and fury of 2017 is that I fear that Kim might see that and the U.S. as a paper tiger. So what fire and fury and this abrupt change or pivot to welcoming a summit with Kim, what that's done has validated Kim's assumption that U.S. has no appetite for war, regardless how much the dog barks, is what the North Koreans said, a frightened dog barks louder. And and there are other reports where, the ambassador to the UN, Nikki Haley, said, she used the fire and fury and talking points to try to get the Chinese to sign on to harsher sanctions. So what's the lesson Kim draws from that? That the U.S. is not interested in war, that South Korea and China will try to restrain the U.S., restrain U.S. efforts. And it also validates Kim's probable assumption that China will not abandon. Ties with the Chinese leader Xi Jinping were in the toilet ever since Xi Jinping and Kim Jong-un came to power almost concurrently. Ties have been really bad. Kim was not interested in making nice with Xi Jinping or the Chinese. Refused to listen to them, prioritize North Korean interests over Chinese interests, which makes sense from Kim's perspective. But what does Xi Jinping do? As soon as the summitry started, Xi Jinping went to North Korea and started this. And even before that, had a series of meetings with Kim Jong-un. Despite the fact that there was no progress on the nuclear issue, despite the fact that Kim wasn't making really demonstrable efforts at reducing the North Korean capabilities that threaten the region. So those are big assumptions that were validated in the past 2 years, that the U.S. does not want war. And secondly, that China will not abandon North Korea, regardless of what kind of weapons it has or what kinds of blustery actions it has undertaken in the past.
All right, so let's turn. The final chapter is a set of policy recommendations, some of which are implied by some of the things that you just said. But I want you to walk us through it. What are we getting wrong in our relations with North Korea and with Kim Jong-un in particular? And what should we be doing differently?
There's some things that we can do regardless of what North Korea is doing, whether we're doing diplomacy or not, whether North Korea is interested in talking or not. And that is making sure that we have a consistent and sustained channel and conversation and dialogue with our allies and partners in the region. I think what has happened in the past 2 years with President Trump is that we have this extreme bilateralization, that this America first concept of doing North Korea policy. And I think the working levels have done a pretty good job at their levels to try to make sure that dialogue is happening and make sure that everybody's on the same page. But I think the fact that there was so much emphasis put on the leader-to-leader relationship between Trump and Kim really reduced the efforts and reduced the power of the whole, which is making sure that South Korea, the U.S., Japan, and China and Russia are of like mind on how to deal with various scenarios, whether it's a shorter range ballistic missile scenario or longer range or more strategic provocations. But given the nature of what's happening in the region now, U.S.-South Korea relations are not great. There's been a persistent tension on the host nation or the burden sharing agreement. The president has not been shy about saying how South Korea doesn't pay enough. Why do we have U.S. troops in South Korea? And so that relationship is, despite what it, at the superficial level, the linchpin of the alliance, the alliance system, so that relationship isn't great. U.S.-China relationship isn't great. And we absolutely need China's support and help and assistance in whether it's in implementing sanctions against North Korea or trying to get North Korea to engage in more substantive, more fruitful dialogue. South Korea-Japan ties are terrible. They've been spiraling downward since 2018, rooted in history issues based on Japanese colonization of Korea from 1910 to 1945. And that, got, seeped into the trade and security issues. So given all of the, some of the fraying of the U.S. alliance networks and within the region itself has really eroded our leverage against North Korea. If Kim has President Trump on his side, turning a blind eye on the shorter range ballistic missile tests or on the human rights issues, that really marginalizes the voice of South Korea as well as Japan. And so I think that really weakens our position. There's that side. But there's also the the internal side, which is I've said that North Korea or Kim Jong-un fears his people as much as he fears the United States, and that Kim's fears are not just about the U.S. attacking, and that the nuclear weapons are not just for deterring the United States or to use that as to conduct lower level acts of provocative actions. But that we have to have another element to our policymaking, which is trying to have greater information penetration. The North Korean people are hungry for information. They almost certainly know what's going on, given the porous border with China. But how do we make the Kim regime more accountable to the people? 40% of North Koreans are malnourished or food insecure. 8 million do not have access to clean water, which in the case like this is, with the pandemic, makes them extremely vulnerable to the ravages of the disease. And so how do we create these pressure points as well as and create an alternative vision for the regime that and convince them that having nuclear weapons doesn't secure regime survival, but that it threatens regime survival, short of military strike that I think would be more counterproductive than not.
We're going to leave it there. The book is Becoming Kim Jong-un, a former CIA officer's insights into North Korea's enigmatic young dictator. The author is my Brookings colleague, Jung Pak. Jung, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Ben. This is wonderful. Thank you.
The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution, as is particularly evident when we have Brookings foreign policy scholars on the show. You need to do your part to promote the Lawfare Podcast. Share it, tweet it, pin it on Pinterest, upvote it on Reddit. Our music is, of course, performed by previous Lawfare podcast guest Sophia Yan. Our audio engineering this episode was by Ian Enright and the folks at Goat Rodeo. The Lawfare podcast is produced and edited by Jen Patya Howell. And as always, thanks for listening and leave us a review.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.